welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650.
Yeah.
I want to pitch you on something after you're
done. Ooh, all right. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here live from the Kintec Studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com. What's going on? Okay, pitch me.
I want to pitch you because I thought last night's game was really funny. There were like lots of things that I really enjoyed. So I thought we could just like talk about things we noticed. I just thought we'd do like,
I love that your pitch is, do you want to make some observations about the game last night? Like, yeah, it's sports talk radio.
No, I know. I know we would have done it anyway, but I want to do it in a more targeted sense.
It's a real high concept.
Things you found funny, things you found interesting.
Okay.
Things we noticed.
I feel like the segment that's going to sweep the nation.
I feel
right
like
there.
This could be a fixture for us.
Things we noticed.
I'll let you start. What was the thing you noticed?
All right. I noticed. I feel like this is not really in the spirit of the segment because I feel like you're thinking more of like ephemera. Right?
No. It can be essential. That's fine.
But we've been having the ongoing conversation about 5-on-5 scoring. And
this
shot
is exactly what
and everything.
I want. Yeah.
There was a play early in the game, I think it was around the 16-minute mark of the first period. Garland, Miller, Joshua are out there. Garland gets the puck behind the goal in the offensive zone, as he does.
In Garland's office.
Yeah, of course, as he does. Skates out along the left wing, along the boards, has tons of time and space. Joshua and Miller plant themselves in front of the net, or at least go to the front of the net. And again, this is Garland. Right now, I would say, like, arguably the team's best forward on form at the moment. Obviously not their actual best forward, but one of the team's best playmakers. And I just found it very frustrating because this should be a time where it's like, okay, Garland has the puck in space. You've got Miller and Joshua in that dirty area in front of the net.
Yeah, you're
time to make a play.
Your best 5-on-5 playmaker.
Yeah, like this is we're time to go right here and make a play.
your best 5-on-5 playmaker with two human backboards down low.
And Joshua and Miller, if you watch it, like they were already as Garland has the puck and surveying the ice, they're facing the blue line. They're not even really like, you know, popping up to get open or moving or creating movement or anything like that. It's like we're setting up a screen already because we know what's going to happen here. And Garland passes it to Zadorov at the point. Relatively soft wrist shot from the point for Zadorov, and the screen timing wasn't just quite right, so it ends up being an easy save for Connor Ingram. And I was looking at that and thinking, for all the debate we have about do the Canucks need another top six winger, and I would say like going forward, absolutely, but we always have this like personnel conversation, you know, what trios can they put together to unlock more offense? That to me was just like a flashing neon light that there's a tactical thing going on here as well. Like Connor Garland's not making that play because he was out of ideas or lacked the capability to do something a little bit more creative and dynamic in that moment.
Yeah.
And it's just, again, look, point shots, it's fine for it to be an element of the offense, but I was just watching that thinking like, man, I would love to see Connor Garland attack the middle of the ice. I would love to see JT Miller get open for a shot in the slot, right? Like I would love to see more creativity and interplay in those moments when they have the opportunity.
I called Garland, by the way, the team's best 5-on-5 playmaker. It's Elias Pettersson, excuse me. I think that's a really good observation because this team's scoring struggles, right, it's a really interesting thing because in some ways it hasn't cost them. You know, like since the All-Star break, the offense has been really tough to come by. Mm-hmm. We all know this. The power play's gone quiet. There's been a lot of narrow games, even against subpar opponents, right? I mean, we just saw this team get outscored 5-on-5 across two games against the Ducks and the Coyotes this week. And those games get frustrating as you go because even though the Canucks are kind of throttling the opponent, there's no margin for error. And then you get that bounce against you. You get that Gunther goal. You get that Zellweger shot. And it's like now the team has to press late in the game against a team you feel like they should be able to pat their heads and send them on their way. And it's not that the team is struggling, right? Like they're just struggling to score in particular. And they're kind of struggling to score despite the fact that, you know, their shooting clip's not, like, their shooting clip's not anemic. It's not that. Only the Blue Jackets, the Sharks, the Blackhawks, the Kraken, and the Ducks have scored goals at a lower rate all situations than Vancouver has since the All-Star break. That's tough company. And yet this team's controlling play, and you know, over the course of that stretch, you know, all those other teams are like well below 500. The Canucks have 31 points in 27 games, which is,
yeah,
you know, at least the level of a playoff team.
It's just like they're probably going to win the division, right? You know, as yep. you said, it hasn't cost them. It's not like, uh-oh, they've really tumbled down the standings here.
No, it hasn't. They haven't at all. I mean, I guess it's partly why they're not going to take home the President's Trophy, and mm-hmm. we don't have to spend a week talking about curses. Thank goodness.
Indeed.
President's Trophy is not a curse. I just want to... Curses don't exist. Anyway. Okay, here's the thing I noticed that I enjoyed. Elias Pettersson, okay, struggling with confidence, clearly. Pretty evident when you watch them play.
And I would just, you know, another note from Jim Rutherford on, he was asked about Elias Pettersson, and it was, hold on, let me just find the quote here. But it was, yeah, he's not himself, but he's still doing okay. It's going to go that way for players, different players at different times. This is something that'll come out of sometimes when it doesn't go your way. You may press a little bit more, and you're just not as relaxed and as comfortable, but he's a terrific player, and I'm certainly not concerned about where he's at.
Good take, Jim Rutherford.
Yeah.
As usual. Anyway. Well, except, no, I'm kidding. Elias Pettersson. With the puck at the blue line and an open net. Like, maybe you score and you start to feel good about yourself, man.
Yep.
And not only does he not take the shot, which, by the way, even if he'd missed, would have just been like a dump in, which
yeah,
is also a totally
icing.
Yeah, which is a totally fine outcome. Sends a like difficult and dangerous pass attempt to Ilya Mikheyev. Okay. If that pass is interfered with or is picked off, is seagulled. The Coyotes defenseman's like rushing at you with five of their buddies, and you've got two guys isolated. Like, that's a dangerous play. And yet Pettersson's so good that he executes it.
Yes.
To Ilya Mikheyev, whose heavy touch is so ham-fisted that the puck falls behind the net. To where the Canucks can't even get a try at the empty net. And I was just watching this, and I was like, there's so much going on, and it's so funny. I was howling at that entire sequence. Not laughing at the Canucks players either. It was just like, it was such a chaotic sequence, right? Mm-hmm. It was like an iffy read, but then a beautiful pass, but then a brutal touch, and you're just like, oh man, this is hilarious. This is the sort of stuff that has to happen to this team.
This is like late March, early April hockey right there.
Yeah, this is the sort of stuff that has to happen for this team for them to have scored fewer goals since the All-Star break than Montreal.
Mm.
Anyway.
This was a funny moment observation.
Yeah, I've got another one of those.
Captioning the various observations that we're making here. Another observation. Archer Seelov's looked really
good.
It's
not observations. It's things I noticed. Yeah.
Sorry. Okay. Another thing I noticed.
What did you notice?
Archer Seelov's looked really good.
he did look good.
And I noticed after the game that Rick Tocchet seemed very, very happy with his performance.
Said he looked big.
Said he looked big in the net.
He also suggested.
Didn't comment on the softness of his hands, but.
No.
We'll see if we get that at some point.
Implied that he was doing a sick job of being a Thatcher Demko cover band,
mm-hmm.
which I liked.
Yeah.
Thing I noticed. So Filip Peronik's grown on me over the course of the season. I still think there's some limitations in terms of some of the defensive work along the wall. You know, I think playing with Hughes helps him a lot because he spends no time in the defensive end. And I think that amplifies some of the stuff he does really well from the blue line in offensively. But there's one attribute that he has that I think makes him kind of a sneaky, effective defenseman and also a sneaky, effective offensive defenseman. And it's a rare skill that we don't often see a player build like a 50-point season on.
Mm-hmm.
But Filip Peronik is always in the way. Okay? Filip Peronik is always in the way whether the Canucks are defending. And he's just like, you know, he might not be stopping the cycle himself, but he's like forcing guys to go around. He's just kind of around the puck and in the way. And it like looks so annoying. And then when the Canucks have the puck, like, I swear, this guy sets picks like an NBA power forward. Him and Quinn Hughes sometimes
look like...
He's
like Karl Malone out there.
Yeah, well, without the baggage. But
yes.
It sometimes looks like him and Quinn Hughes are executing pick and rolls. Like, that's how in the way he is. Now, sequence late in the game, where the Coyotes ice the puck twice. Okay. And on both cases, it's Quinn Hughes skating back, and there's no way that he's not going for icing. Like, it's going for icing. Quinn Hughes is winning that race 800,000 times out of 800,000, right? It's like 100%, but 100% with a wild amount of confidence. And despite that, Filip Hronek, instincts so strong, he's just like skating in the lane of the puck carrier anyway. Like, he just like, he's just like, I'm just going to softly interfere with the Coyotes forward chasing Quinn Hughes down, even though they're 20 strides behind both times. And I was just like, that's a master at work. Like, let him cook.
Of accidentally being in the way. Accidentally being in the way.
Well, that, because that's why it's a skill. Anyone can be in the way.
Yes.
The skill is, can you be in the way without ever being called for it? Especially given that we've seen teams, like, we've seen referees crack down on this, and we haven't seen Hronek impacted at all.
Yeah, that's
like they're
true.
They're calling the thing that Hronek is literally doing every single shift tighter, and he never gets called for it. He's a genius. It's like he's like the evolutionary Rusty Klesla. It's unbelievable. A reference everyone will understand.
Yes, of course, the evolutionary Rusty Klesla.
Hey, Rusty Klesla
like
was
a Pokemon
good player.
Who's evolved into Filip Hronek.
Yeah, he's awesome. I honestly love it. I think it's such an underrated skill.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say that Filip Hronek has grown on me over the course of the season, just because he was so good at the start of the year, and I do think it's fallen off a little bit, but I think you're right.
I think it's fallen off a fair bit.
You're right, yeah. So I just, like, I wouldn't necessarily track it that way, you know what I mean? Chart my opinion of the player as falling from the beginning of the year, because it went up a lot.
Oh, see, I wasn't really buying a lot of I never thought he'd get to 70 points.
Yeah.
I thought he might get to 60 at one point, right? When the especially given how many shots the Canucks take, but my opinion was pretty low on him coming into the season, and even when this team was winning games early, you know, I was like, well, those results look a lot like what they looked like with Ethan Bear on Hughes's right side.
Mm-hmm.
So, but over the course of the season, I've been really impressed with a lot of what he does, including sort of the sneaky toughness and the ability to be in the way. I like that.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think Tahai is just like a savvy thing to do that's not going to get noticed an awful lot, but helps the team and helps the team in both directions.
It gives him sneaky defensive value, even though, you know, you can notice some of the, like, especially along the wall, right? Like, he's not a cycle stopper. I'll just put it that way. Like, he's not a guy who's coming in and stopping the cycle or coming off the wall after a 50-50 battle with control of the puck, right? He's not like an individual puck rusher. Like, there's some things that I think people have started to focus on as this team's...
As the results have dipped.
Have the results have become... But it's not just results. It's also the process of watching them has been more frustrating.
Sure.
But I've actually come to appreciate how he succeeds despite some of those things that I think you notice and get frustrated by.
Yes, indeed. By the way, just before we go to break here, and we will talk to Jeremy Colleton, a little bit of Abbotsford-related news. The Canucks announcing that general manager Patrick Alvin has announced that Archdeep Baines has been assigned to Abbotsford. So not a big surprise there based on where his game was trending. The scratch last night, Archdeep Baines officially sent down to Abbotsford. And we will chat to the Abbotsford Canucks head coach Jeremy Colleton next. Got a couple new players in the fold. They've clinched the playoffs. Lots going on with the Abbey Canucks. That's coming up here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz here. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLE
AMC.com. We are live from the Kintech studio. Kintech, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? And it's now time for the Abbey Farm Report. The Abbey Farm Report is a presentation of David L. Young of Dexter Realty. And we're very pleased to be joined for the Abbey Report by the head coach of the Abbotsford Canucks, Jeremy Colleton. Jeremy, thank you for doing this. Always a pleasure to chat with you. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. And first of all, congratulations on the team officially clinching a spot in the Calder Cup playoffs. So what does that mean for you? What does it say about your team and the season they've had so far?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's always a goal to get in. I think those games, that environment, that experience is huge for our young players to be exposed to and to have a chance to show, you know, where they're at. And so to clinch is great. I mean, we've known we're going to be in for a while just by the way the standings have kind of sorted out. But we've certainly been doing everything we can to try and position ourselves seed-wise. I mean, playing at home would be, you know, fantastic. The environment in our rink in the playoffs is pretty special, and obviously, especially the first round where, you know, it's either three at home or three on the road, that's pretty important. So, you know, we've had a bit of an uphill climb, but we put ourselves in the mix, and so, you know, these are playoff games as well. That's how we've been approaching them. So that kind of experience, it helps everyone, and we're using it as a dress rehearsal. So hopefully when we do get to the playoffs, our guys who are in their first or second year, they got a few more reps under their belt, and hopefully we're ready.
Jeremy, it's nice to chat with you when I'm not playing guilty at the airport, but just wanted to ask you about a couple of guys who've come on down the stretch for you. Atu Ratu, obviously, is on a hellacious scoring run, and Aiden McDonough now has 9 points in his last 13 after a relatively slow start, something we frequently see from rookies in the American League. What's been the key for those two young prospects kind of finding their game offensively of late?
Yeah, I think they both are gaining confidence with the puck, their ability to make plays. They're finding themselves in good situations to use their skill, shot, hockey sense to make things happen. I think a lot of it you can tie to their motor. I think they've found an extra gear to that motor. You know, pressure on the puck, back pressure, forechecking, using their work ethic when they don't have the puck to force turnovers, and that helps them and the guys that are on the ice with to have the puck a little bit more. You create transition chances, and then their skill can come through. So I think that's part of it. Just understanding in the pro game what's required to have the puck. And then, you know, they've been able to take advantage of it. So that's it's nice to see. And just they've added some extra depth to our lineup. And when they do get rewarded with production, it's easier to keep doing it. I think sometimes when you do the hard work and you don't get rewarded, it can be a mental challenge. Like, why am I doing this again? You know, but I think they've been rewarded, and hopefully they can build on it, build confidence, and keep taking steps.
Speaking of adding some depth to your lineup, a couple of high-profile prospects have recently joined the team, coming over from Sweden in Jonathan Lekkerimäki and Elias Pettersson on the blue line. And before we get into some of the specifics with those players and your early impressions, just in general, how do you approach integrating young players, you know, playing in the AHL for the first time at this point of the season when, as you said, you know, you're really treating these as tune-up games for the Calder Cup playoffs coming up here?
Yeah, it's bringing new guys in. It's always tricky. I mean, obviously, even at the NHL level, you talk about, you know, bringing guys in the deadline, and does that upset the chemistry and those questions? But I think at our level, we're kind of used to guys moving in and out, and you never know how long you have players for, and that's just part of it. So, you know, guys coming into the end of the year, you expect it, you're ready for it. It's more trying to get them up to speed as far as how we want to play, what's expected of the group, what the standards are, and then, you know, can they practice, can they Can they get to a point where they can help? And then if they can contribute to the team winning and be part of it, I think they're quickly accepted, and it's no problem to plug a guy in, and they rally around him. If you play a guy who can't contribute, that's when you have trouble. So I think, you know, those guys have done a great job. They come in and they've been part of it. They're, you know, fit into the group, part of the group. You got a guy like, you know, Petey. We call him Petey so far. We'll have to work on that. But, no, I think he comes in and he runs a guy over and he sticks up for a teammate. Those things, he blocks a shot. You know, like those things quickly endear you to your teammates. And you, it's like you've been here for 2 years. So those are, you know, those are important things to go through. And, you know, they're just one of the guys. So that's important.
You know, you mentioned some of the early physical elements that Elias Pettersson is bringing to the team. And, you know, we kind of knew that was going to be his calling card and something that would allow him to step in and, as you said, kind of build that reputation right away in the AHL. For Jonathan Lekaramäki, what have your first impressions been of the player, you know, skating with the team, getting in a couple of games? And how do you see his role developing for, you know, as long as he's with Abbotsford right now?
Yeah, I think, you know, his shot obviously jumps off the page, but you could see that even when he was drafted, you know, whatever, a week later, he's going to summer camp and everyone could see his release and how it explodes off the stick. So that's still there. I think just what I've noticed is his pace. He can skate, and I think that's helped him adjust to our level. He hasn't looked out of place. There's going to be an adjustment with just all the traffic and the contact and the board battles. And I think he's, when I met with him, that was one of the first things he brought up, is he was surprised about how much play is on the walls and kind of how the games are. You know, it's a bit of a attrition out there. And can you move pucks forward? Can you get a puck out on the wall? You know, that'll, if you do that enough times, then you start to get a little more offensive zone time and more plays on the puck. I think he had the puck more here at home. Obviously, we controlled more of the play, just how it is a lot of times. But I think the more games he gets, the more comfortable he'll be. And, you know, whatever happens here, this experience he's getting playing important games for us, it's only going to help him.
How do you approach designing? You know, it's pretty unique that you'll get a player like Lekaramäki over and there's a potential sort of end date in mind with the possibility that he'll head back to Sweden to join the team for the Worlds. How do you sort of design downloading information to him that could help him next year if he comes back to the American League, given just sort of the unique parameters of this particular loan?
Yeah, I don't think it's changed my approach. Mm-hmm. Initially, just how can we get him ready to play as quickly as possible without giving him too much information so that he can't, you know, we need him to play on instinct as much as possible. We need him to be predictable to his teammates. You know, it's
right.
That's the balance. And then once we get him into a few games, then you can start giving him some feedback and helping him adjust as quickly as possible. I mean, as far as the end game, it's just like any other player. Like, you never know how long you're going to have these guys. So, to be honest, just like every other player, when they're here, I'm doing everything I can to help them, you know, improve and be, you know, at some point be able to play at the next level. And you never know when that's going to end. So, I just think it's a normal part of the league, I guess.
When you have an opportunity to watch a recently called up player. I mean, I know Baines just got reassigned back to Abbotsford, but whether it's a Podkolzin or a Baines, one of the players that we've seen play down the stretch lately here, when you get a chance to see those players play at the NHL level, what things do you tend to look for? What things do you tend to look for as like reinforcement of the work you're doing to prepare guys for the NHL level? Just a thing I've always been curious to ask.
Yeah, I'm looking for things that will allow them to get another shift. You know,
like, yeah,
that's ultimately what it is. When I'm coaching my team, I want to know that there's guys I can trust to put on the ice with the game on the line. Mm. And the more of those players I have, the more depth we have, the better our team is, the more difficult we are to play against. And so when our guys get a chance in the NHL, I'm watching the shifts. Do they get a puck out? Do they keep a play alive? Can they protect the puck in the offensive zone? When they end their shift, are they in the offensive zone or are they in the defensive zone? Because that, to me, you know, when talks on the bench, he's looking for guys he can put on the ice that will get him out of D zone and end in the offensive zone. And so those little details that, you know, whether he produces or not, that's kind of a side issue. That'll come or not over time. But, you know, as far as is he going to get another shift? Is he going to get another game? That's what I'm looking for, hoping to see for our guys.
On Elias Pettersson, I know, you know, as you mentioned, he has that physical element, kind of hit the ground running a little bit in those terms early in his AHL career. What are kind of the next steps that you're going to want to see from him? I mean, I know we're talking short term here, but, you know, over the next few weeks, but also generally as his AHL career continues, what are those next steps for Elias Pettersson?
Yeah, just consistency. And, you know, it's kind of like we talk about the guys who get called up to the NHL. Like, you can do it for a game. You can do it for three games. Can you do it for 5, 10, 15? As the level goes up, you know, big games, playoff games, can you continue to be keep improving? And it's a fun time of year to evaluate players. I think you learn a lot because it's real hockey. You know, everyone's ready. Everyone's prepared. There's a lot on the line. And how guys react in those situations tells you a lot about where they're at and where they got to get to. So it's fun.
Another player we've seen come up recently from Abbotsford and help the NHL Canucks is Archer Seelovs in net, picking up a couple of wins over the last week in the NHL. And, you know, I know it wasn't necessarily the most straightforward season for Seelovs, maybe some ups and downs in there, but he does come up and looks really, really comfortable in his first two NHL games of the season. What do you think that says about just his mentality and his preparation that he was able to seamlessly step in and perform really well at the NHL level?
Yeah, it's a great sign. You know, this year was a new thing where he was kind of expected to come in and be the starter for us. And it's a lot. It's a lot of responsibility. It's a different level of preparation. And Tolo's done a good job of competing with him. But I think, it's been great for him to work through that little bit of adversity, finding consistency. And now he gets the call up, and it was a new thing where he had to just sit and wait for a bit and, you know, do everything he could to prepare for his chance. And so having gone through that and doing pretty well, that's just more experience under his belt that he can rely on whatever comes up in the future. So I think this is part of his growth. Still a really young player, still gaining experience at our level, at obviously the top level. And it's great.
Jeremy, really appreciate the time. Thank you for doing this. Congratulations again on clinching the playoff spot. And I know a lot of fans here in the Fraser Valley are very excited to watch some Abbotsford Canucks playoff games.
Awesome. Should be a fun time of year here on all fronts.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks.
That is Jeremy Colleton, head coach of the Abbotsford Canucks. And yeah, as I said, lots going on with the Abbey Canucks right now, bringing in Elias Pettersson, Jonathan Lekkerimäki. As you said, unique circumstances with Lekkerimäki as well, even beyond just bringing in a top prospect late in the season. I did want to just focus on Archer Seelovs for a second. You know, he comes up and, as I said, looks really good in his two games, helps the Canucks get a couple of wins, albeit against Anaheim and Arizona, but they needed him in those games. He needed to make some key saves in those games. And I know you wrote a little bit in your piece at The Athletic about just the Seelovs question going forward and how it could play out, what it could mean for the Canucks. I thought it was interesting that Rick Dhaliwal earlier, when we had him on for the crossover, said, you know, even as late as like the middle of August of this, before this past season, the Canucks were thinking Seelovs might be the backup coming into this year until they were able to get Casey DeSmith. You hear that and you think, okay, with DeSmith as a UFA, is it all of a sudden more likely than not that Seelovs is the backup next year?
Well, remember, it wasn't clear exactly where Pearson's status was trending toward.
Right.
Right? It wasn't clear whether the Canucks could afford, frankly, a backup who made $1.8 million, right? And by the way, it's going to be really interesting even next season with an $87.5 million upper limit. You know, team only has $24 million in projected space now.
That's a huge element here. How much do you want to invest in the backup spot next year?
Well, and And here's the thing, and this is going to be decisive too in how we should and will react should the club do a Joshua deal or a Myers deal or what have you, right? Hughes, Soucy, Juulsen. That's it. On the blue line, signed beyond this season. So you've got $24 million, roughly, as it stands. Obviously, the club can figure out ways to open up new wiggle room, right? You'd assume that guys like Besser and Garland have restored trade value. Ilya Mikheyev is sort of an interesting one to watch and think about, too. So there's other things that this team can do to open up cap space, but realistically, rebuilding your blue line has to be priority number one, and going cheap with your backup spot, I'm not saying it's necessary, but it feels like a good aggressive way to invest as much as possible into certainly the blue line, but also, you know, we'd say stuff like another top six forward. And by the way, 100%. And by the way, so would the club. So you have to fill out your blue line, ideally keep some of the glue guys who've played a huge role in this team's success, and DeSmith's expiring too, and there's a question at backup, and this is sort of where the fact that Seelovs is, you know, his entry-level deal will expire. He's going to be an RFA with no arbitration rights. That puts the team in the driver's seat in a major way. Right, there's all sorts of things they can do to keep him at, you know, 800K at the NHL level. I mean, honestly, he's waiver exempt next season. If you give him a one-way deal, right, because his qualifying offer, accepting that qualifying offer alone, only entitles him to a two-way deal, right? Like, a one-way deal alone is like one way to leverage a guy into taking a cap hit that's extremely agreeable. You know, if Seelovs is as good as he's looked at the NHL level, he's played seven games, he's got a 9-1-3, I mean, that could be a huge competitive edge for you. And yet, you know, I think we need to think about this a little bit differently. Like, the fact that DeSmith has been so steady for this team, the fact that they've won so many of games in which their backup has started, I mean, I'm not saying it makes the difference for the Canucks between them being a playoff team and not, because they've been a playoff team all year, but it's certainly the difference between being where
the
Kings
division,
are,
100%,
you know, or where the Oilers are when they and where they are. I mean, he's picked up points in 17 of his 25 starts. It's ridiculous.
I think the other thing that enters into it when you're talking about aggressively going cheap on your backup, and I'm not even saying this would be the wrong move, because I totally understand why that's an option teams go for, especially when you have Thatcher Demko, but you also have to be sure you're creating an environment where you're comfortable going to your backup, right? Because again, Thatcher Demko, another season where he's injured towards the end of the year. Now, it might work out in the Canucks' favor, right? But where they get him fresh for the playoffs. But if you can't go in with Seelovs as the backup unless you have rock solid alignment through the coaching staff that you're willing to get him, you know, 25 plus games, right? Because otherwise, if there's any nerves about it, it's just a recipe for, you know, 60 plus starts for Thatcher Demko. And I don't think that's a recipe for long-term success for this team, right? So like, that's the big caveat to me, is you can only do it. I get wanting to save the money, but you have to be sure everyone's on the same page and that you're going to stick to a plan of actually getting him those games.
Well, and for me, the fact that you have Thatcher Demko is one of the reasons why I'd be hesitant to see this team go full budget at the backup spot, right?
Because you're already getting a budget on that, or a bargain on Thatcher Demko.
You're already getting a bargain on Thatcher Demko, and B, Thatcher Demko is going to turn 29 next season, and we haven't seen him throw together one of those 50, 55, 60 game seasons in which at the end of the year he's healthy. You know, like, there's all, and not that he's not going to be healthy on his return here, but like, there was still an injury. There was still a multi-week absence here, right? Durability doesn't tend to be a skill that increases with age. That's something that I'd want to be very conscious of in building my plans in net, and that I think the Canucks need to at least be mindful of. I don't think you want to take on too much risk that you'll put a coach at any point in a position where they feel pressure to start Demko more than is like advisable for the long term, not his long term health, but for like the long term health of his readiness come playoff time.
Yeah. You know? 100%. Now, on the other side of things, I do think there's an issue, or not an issue here, but a question with Seelovs, where it's, you know, he just turned 23.
he's still very young by goaltending standards, obviously.
Yeah,
but
do you want him to be the backup?
At a certain point, do you think he can be a starter down? I'm not asking you. I'm saying, like, does the organization think he has starter potential down the road? Well, you have to start building towards that at some point, right? First step is to be the backup, be legitimately the backup who can play 25 or 30 games. You know, if it's not next year, then you're looking at going into, like, his age 24, 25 season down the road. And
that's okay, though.
It is, but it's like, don't you want to find out a little bit, too, here? Like, don't. It feels like it's time for that next step in his development to a certain degree.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, though, is he's still waiver exempt for one more season.
Yeah.
You know? So, to me anyway, that gives you some flex, I suppose, to, like, build, you know, and maybe it's the middle course, right? Like, the middle course where you go out and you find, you know, the $1 million guy who struggled this past season but has a decent track record, like a Phoenix Copley. You're probably going to be able to get Phoenix Copley for, like, $1 million, you know? Do something like that and hold a true competition at training camp with kind of the idea in your head that the way we're going to try and approach this is that, you know, Seelovs is going to play 40 games, 40 or 50 games next season. We're just going to split them between the American League and the NHL, right? Like, he's going to be a backup for 10 games. If there's an injury, he's going to be the guy we run with as sort of the starter. He's going to be the starter in Abbotsford, and we're going to use the proximity of Abbotsford to platoon him up and down as required, you know, so that we get the development out of it, but also give him an NHL shot with the idea that you're going to make him, you know, a backup thereafter. And one advantage of that approach is you can do something sort of like the Carolina Hurricanes did with that Kochetkov contract,
yeah,
where, you know, you can even consider signing him at, like, $1.25 million for 3 years or something like that. You know what I mean? Where you have the ability to lock in some upside beyond if you really do think he's a starter. So, again, you're right that the internal evaluation has to play a role in it, too, because there's different ways you can structure it in your favor as he continues to develop. But all of this, I think, dovetails with the micro conversation of Saturday night and should Seelovs play again. And for me, especially if you're going to be careful with Demko's gradual return prior to the postseason, to me, like, there's going to still be two or three DeSmith starts, even if he doesn't start Saturday. And I kind of want to see what Seelovs can do, you know, having overcome the adversity of a pretty inconsistent American League season. And having performed so well in his two NHL games to this point, like, I'd very much like to see what he looks like against non-Ducks, Coyotes tier opponents.
It's going to be a fascinating decision to see what Rick Tocchet and staff do. One thing I did want, I wanted to read this text from the inbox. You were speaking about cap allocation next year and, you know, what positions they might want to spend it on. This text comes in: you'd think they have to invest in a running mate for Petey as a priority this offseason. You don't invest $90 million into a guy without ensuring he has favorable conditions to perform. We really can't be playing next year without a high caliber line mate for him. And interestingly enough, as you said, the team is looking for, like, they are acknowledging the need for more top six wingers. Jim Rutherford today to Ian McIntyre, IMAC asks him, how much work have you left to do building this team? Rutherford, you have to work at it all the time. You're always going to have some changes with players. Even teams that win the Stanley Cup don't come back with the same team. We always have work to do. Goes on to say, maybe we'll look at getting some more production from our wingers, whether we project some guys to do better next year, or we have to go out and get another winger or two that can help us on the offensive side. So basically explicitly highlighting need for top six offensive wingers in their offseason shopping list.
I mean, at this point, it's a red flashing light.
Yep.
You know, and I think the Canucks were onto this before the fan base, right? Like, there was a reason Lindholm and Gensel were such key targets for them ahead of the deadline. There's a reason they kicked the tires on guys like Toffoli. You know, like, they knew that they needed another winger who could help them score, even as the results were top of the league. And now, you know, I think we're seeing it on an every game basis, and fans' frustration is growing. But, you know, to this organization's credit, I think they'd identified that as a need long before it was apparent in their results. The thing, again, comes back to, like, I mean, $24 million in cap space. I find it impossible to imagine that the lion's share of that doesn't have to be committed to rebuilding this blue line. And not rebuilding it necessarily in terms of personnel, but in terms of contracts.
By spending money on the players to play there. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that to me is going to be the first thing to sort through. And yet, you know, I'm not going to like be critical of them having the order wrong or the priority wrong. If it's like a Joshua deal gets announced in the next week or so, I'm just saying, you know, that to me is that would be what would keep me up at night. Going into this offseason, if I were Canucks manager.
It does frame the Joshua thing in an interesting way as well, because not that he can't help you score, of course he can, but it does put him more in the luxury item silo, right? Like, if you're thinking, hey, we need to go out and potentially get a couple of offensive-minded wingers, is Joshua one of those, or is he someone farther down the lineup, and then we still need to go get those two guys, right? Because if it's the latter, and you still need to go out and add a couple names, then it's hard to justify spending what it's going to take to keep him.
Well, and then what does that mean for Ilya Mikheyev?
Yeah.
You know what, and then what does that mean for Pugh Suter or whomever, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a fascinating dynamic, and this club will have a fascinating offseason, but first,
we got the playoffs.
Let's have some fun.
Yeah. All right. We'll talk about that. We'll do the whiteboard to wrap up the show here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650, Jamie Dodd, Thomas Durant. We are live from the Kintec studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at DunbarLumber.com. All right, we did the crossover in our first segment today, so let's get into the whiteboard right now.
All right, now, fellas, hey, let's focus up, huh?
It is your daily deep dive into what's up with the Canucks for today, April 4th, and the headline is the Canucks, they get the 2 points. They beat the Coyotes 2-1 at Mullet Arena last night. And hey, 2 points is 2 points. Yes, they needed a late third period goal, a nice goal from Connor Garland, to get the victory against the Coyotes. But still, they take home 2 points. And I'm going to rob from a later portion of the whiteboard here a little bit, Drancer, and say that a part of this headline is that because of the results last night, the Canucks are now firmly in control. Not home free, but firmly in control in the Pacific Division, up 5 points on the Edmonton Oilers, who have two games in hand on them.
It's only 5 points? I thought it was seven.
Oh my gosh. I got it wrong yesterday, too. You're right. It is seven. They're up seven. Oh, my.
You know, there's no missions, Jamie.
Okay. You know what happens here? When you go to the NHL.com standings page, in the URL, there's the date.
Right.
So if you hit refresh, like, it's open. I always have it open. But if I hit refresh the following day, it refreshes yesterday's standings.
Oh.
Which is foolish to me.
Just another problem with the NHL standings page, which should also sort by point percentage.
100%. Another problem with the NHL standings page. So anyways,
I thought it was infallible.
Yes, they are 7 points up, and the Oilers have two games in hand. Now, there's also...
They have also a brutal schedule,
They have
right?
a brutal schedule. There is a head-to-head meeting as well.
Yep.
But look, 7 points up, three games in hand. Or sorry, with, you know, Edmonton has two games in hand. Edmonton only has 8 games remaining in this one. So you're getting to the point where
the Canucks would have to choke.
Yeah. This will be a massive, massive choke down the stretch here if they don't end up winning the Pacific Division. Other, you know, we did a whole segment on things we noticed from the game earlier in the show. But in terms of kind of headline items from last night's game, Quinn Hughes, sensational goal and an assist, and just generally was all over the ice, far and away the Canucks' best player.
Yeah, and one thing that I thought was kind of interesting was the Canucks outchanced the Coyotes 12-2, which is how the game felt like for large portions of it.
Mm-hmm.
But without Quinn Hughes on the ice, the Coyotes outchanced the Canucks 15-11. All those numbers are at 5-on-5.
Quinn Hughes is really important to this team.
Is the level to which this team is now dependent on Quinn Hughes a concern?
100%. Yeah. 100% it's a concern. Because,
and it doesn't mean they're not a good team. Like, it kind of reminds me of the Avs last year, actually, and how without, in minutes without MacKinnon on the ice, it was just like really hard for them to score or generate offense or control play, and it cost them when they bumped into like a really deep Kraken team. It kind of reminds me of that sort of build, which, you know, if you told me before the season that I'd be comparing the Canucks to the 2023 Colorado Avalanche, I'd be like, great, wow.
Sign me up.
That's tremendous. But it does feel at times like this is a team that's a little bit, you know, we're used to talking about like a one-line team as opposed to a one-pair team. And I'm not saying that's what the Canucks are, but it has felt like it with maybe a slightly disturbing amount of frequency of late.
Yeah, I think it's 100% fair to raise that as an issue. Now, as you said, they're like, that doesn't mean they're doomed to fail in the first round or anything. And look, Quinn Hughes is going to play an awful lot.
Everything negative now is, and that's why they're doomed to fail in the first round. And it's like, no one's doomed to fail in the first round.
No,
guys.
That's not what's happening here. But
except the Predators last year.
I think you would just love to be in a position where, okay, Quinn Hughes can be your main driver, but then whoever of Pettersson's line or Miller's line that's not on the ice with Quinn Hughes, right? Because you know one of those guys with Quinn Hughes on the ice, the Canucks are going to be in a really good position, right? The team is in a very strong position to carry play, but you would like the other one of those lines anchored by one of those centers to not necessarily, you know, need Quinn Hughes on the ice as well in order to be able to tilt the ice a little bit. And I think that's what we're not really seeing. It feels like almost whichever line is getting more Quinn Hughes minutes on a given night is kind of the one that's clicking the most. I think Connor Garland has been a huge driver. But even, you know, even there, like looking at it last night, you can see the splits in terms of the underlying numbers when he was on with Quinn Hughes versus when he wasn't on with Quinn Hughes. So it's definitely something like they need another group, another guy, whatever it is, who can really tilt the ice for them in big moments. Having said that, Quinn Hughes is going to play like half the game in the playoffs.
Correct.
So if he's able to do that consistently, I mean, that's actually pretty impressive and a pretty strong thing to have for the Canucks going into the playoffs. Other things from headlines, I mean, we talked quite a bit about the offensive struggles, which I thought were on display again last night, especially without Quinn Hughes on the ice. Archer Seelovs comes in, gets his second win in three games, looks really solid, and also gets some praise from the head coach after the game. And as you said, that kind of raises the question of whether he'll get another start. That would be 3-4, two in a row against LA on Saturday. We'll see what happens there, but good for Archer Seelovs coming in and getting another 2 points for the Canucks after being called up from Abbotsford. Another headline I want to throw in here, and I've been reading, I've been kind of doling out over the course of the show quotes from Jim Rutherford and his interview with Ian McIntyre on Sportsnet.ca. I'll throw in another one here. So a couple of them. One, Rutherford's answer to, are you concerned you won't have your best team ready for the playoffs? With Ian McIntyre, of course, referencing injuries to Thatcher Demko and Elias Lindholm. Rutherford says, quote, I'm not concerned at all. He also goes on to say he's actually glad they've dealt with some adversity because he thinks it's going to help them. But the headline there on the injuries, will you have your best team ready for the playoffs? I'm not concerned at all, from Jim Rutherford. And on Philip Hronek and negotiations, his answer is, There's nothing I can tell you contract-wise other than the fact that we like this player and he has brought a certain element of his team and helped us get to where we are, but he's also a free agent that will be on the upper end of the scale as far as a cap hit. Hopefully we can figure out something at some point in time. So Jim Rutherford breaking it down, they like him, but they're also well aware of how expensive Filip Hronek is going to be if they want to keep him in Vancouver.
So lots to unpack there. I mean, I think the Hronek thing, you know, we knew this when the trade happened.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, one of the main reasons I was critical of it was the amount of upside lost versus the amount of upside gained, right? In that if this worked, it was going to necessarily be something that only worked short-term cap-wise because Hronek was going to have arbitration rights and that was going to be complicated and his next deal was going to be prohibitively expensive. Now, I didn't see it working to the 98th percentile the way it has. Hronik's going to be a 50-point player. He's led the Canucks in minutes played. He's been a major reason why the team has had one of the biggest year-over-year improvements of the cap era. And that just lends sort of heft to a wildly strong arbitration case, right? I mean, Hronek is, without question, in range to be a $7.5 to $8.5 million player, without question. And when we've discussed this in the past, I've often talked about 8.5 not really being the ceiling necessarily, although definitely is for an arbitration case. So, you know, this is one where what the Canucks will tell you is they have time to keep the players that they want to keep, provided that they want to stay in Vancouver, right? They're going to have to, with so many expiring deals, they're going to have to find fair deals with these guys without question. I don't think there's any ability on any of these players to pay them to a level, you know, that would be like market value, frankly, right? Or certainly not the upper end, the upper range of their market value. It's going to be like Pettersson, right? Like we talked about Nylander being the floor. We talked about, you know, higher deals being the ceiling. And Pettersson ended up coming in
just above the floor.
Yeah. And that's the sort of dynamic to watch for here. It's going to take some time, I think, certainly Rutherford's implying it, on Hronek.
Mm-hmm.
In part because he's got unique leverage points. The club's got a lot to sort out, especially on the blue line. Hronek's the biggest piece of that pie, the biggest piece of that puzzle to work through. And, you know, it's not going to be panic-inducing if the playoffs start without a Hronek extension done.
I think it would be very surprising if it got done before the playoffs.
I think it's going to be like really
very surprising.
Honestly, in some ways, these deals, especially when they're complicated and the leverage on the player side is so significant, these are deals that often go into the summer.
100%.
Which begs the question, too, you know, is that the sort of timeline the Canucks will be comfortable with, or is this something that they'll want to have wrapped up before the draft? But again, that's a conversation for June.
Yeah, your point about floor and ceilings, though, is why the specific phrasing from Rutherford there, he's also a free agent that will be on the upper end of the scale as far as cap hit, I thought was really interesting. Mm-hmm. And not that he's saying, and therefore he'll be too expensive, right? He's also saying we like him and we want to get something done. But I thought that was just a really, typically Rutherfordian direct acknowledgement of the scenario that they're in with how expensive Filip Hronek is going to be. Broadsheet segment. Just the one thing I wanted to pass along was Elliot Friedman was on Donnie and Dolly earlier today talking about the Elias Lindholm situation, and you know, Friedman said he had heard this kind of rumor that Lindholm might just sit out until the playoffs start and then be back for game one as he tries to get healthy and tries to get ready to go for the playoffs, but then Friedman said he also was told not to go with that, so not reporting that, not saying that is the case, just something he heard, but was also cautioned against believing too much, which only increases the mystery surrounding Elias Lindholm Drancer. I know Dollywall was saying, you know, hey, it's a good sign that he's on this trip. Maybe it is just a case of, okay, they know he can come back and he will be able to come back, but it's just giving him as much time as possible to rest up. But it's really, really difficult to make sense of this one and to kind of figure out where it's going. And I think it's going to be difficult until we see Elias Lindholm on the ice in a game with the team.
Teams get guarded on injury information at this time of year, as you'd expect. And the Lindholm one in particular is one, you know, I mean, my sense of it in asking around has typically been that there's less certainty and a little bit more concern. But, you know, that's partly my interpretation on Lindholm than there has been on Demko, for sure. So, yeah, I mean, I can't answer you like what the dynamic is here. I think we're just going to have to wait and see. You know, there's a variety of possible explanations here. Will certainly be interesting. The club could certainly use him back in the lineup.
Yeah, and it's just interesting, too, the idea of holding him out until game one of the playoffs would be so much more palatable if he had found some chemistry and found a role and was having success before he was out, right? The combination of the two things, bouncing around the lineup, you know, underwhelming performance, team maybe not happy with what they're getting, and then this injury and the potential of being out until the playoffs is a really dicey situation for a player who I still think, you know, in the right circumstances could play an important role for this team. Lineup notes, as we mentioned earlier in the show, the Canucks announced today that Arshdeep Bains sent down, reassigned to the Abbotsford Canucks, and not a big surprise, right? I think we'd all kind of started to see some of the areas of concern, the areas that need improvement for Arshdeep Bains as he pursues becoming a full-time NHL player. Scratched last night, obviously, in Arizona.
Would you say concerns? You're going to go as far as concerns?
Well, not that, like, future concerns, but, like, reasons why he's not in the lineup right now. You know, like, things he needs to improve on.
Yeah, the stuff that he's maybe not ready for.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Not, like, I'm not saying that I'm all of a sudden concerned about what he's going to do in the future based on this NHL thing. I just mean, like, there's reasons, as Jeremy Collin was saying, like, reasons he might not get another game, right?
Yep.
I think you saw some of those things. Now, I think it's still great for Arshdeep Bains that he was able to play NHL games this year. Yeah, I think that's phenomenal.
And play them well.
Yeah.
Right. So, for the most part, I mean, that Vegas game was tough, but, you know, that's it too, right? Like, you have to, it helps to know how far away you are, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go back down with a clear idea of what you need to work on, what the standard is, more experience, more information, all of those things, right? And I think this year it's impossible to look at this season as anything but a home run from Arshdeep Bains, even if he's, you know, doesn't end up sticking with the team and playing more games for them down the stretch. All right, playoff forecast. As I mentioned, big night of results for the Vancouver Canucks last night. They beat Arizona 2-1. The Oilers get thumped by the Stars 5-0 in Dallas. So with that pair of results, as we previewed on the show yesterday, Drancer, the Canucks all the way up to a 78% chance to win the division per Dom Lucision's model at The Athletic. Now, the really interesting thing about this for me is, as much as we look at this as, okay, you want to win the division in general, but you also specifically want to win it to, one, avoid Vegas and try to force Edmonton and Vegas to play each other in the first round, the results of last night didn't really change the most likely playoff matchups for the first round in the Pacific Division at all, right? Mm. It's still Vegas with a 36% chance of being the Canucks' first-round playoff opponent, LA with a 31% chance. Now, LA, I believe, won last night. They did. They beat the Kraken. So there's it's not just what the Canucks are doing that's influencing this, right? Because that increased LA's chances of catching Vegas, so they could end up being in the third spot in the Pacific Division, and then the Canucks could play Vegas as the second wild card. There's still obviously a chance that Edmonton catches the Canucks, so there are still routes to the Canucks and Vegas meeting in the first round, and it's still just above a 50% chance that it's Edmonton-Vegas in round one. So it's Vegas 36% chance by the model, LA with a 31%, and then Nashville with a 28% chance of being the Canucks' first round opponent. So yes, really strengthened their hold on the Pacific Division, but didn't really change who they're likely to meet up and match up with in the first round of the playoffs, which is, this one is going to be really, really fascinating to monitor down the stretch.
I think a big reason for it is how soft LA's schedule is, right? LA's got two road games. They're both in California. Like, LA is playing dregs of the league almost the rest of the way with very little travel. And I think the model just assumes that they're going to pick up enough points to at least make it interesting for that third spot in the Pacific. That I think is the key dynamic here. So you want to avoid the Golden Knights losing on Monday would go a long way. Beat the Kings on Saturday.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah,
lose to the Golden Knights on on Monday, baby.
Yeah. As now that you feel really good about the division, especially if you beat the Kings, then all of a sudden the incentives in that Vegas game are very interesting.
Very weird.
very interesting. They're not going to do
that,
obviously. But just in terms of rooting interest, if you are trying to get them to avoid Vegas, that becomes an interesting one.
I just want to spotlight a couple things on the gambling odds. The first is that with three goals across his last two games, the Quinn Hughes Norris stuff is very much back to being comfortable. Minus 700, the field's back to plus 400. It got a little tighter than that, not like actually tight, but
no,
a little tighter than that over the course of the past week with Makar on a scoring binge and the Predators rolling.
And the Preds have lost three in a row now. So that puts a big dent in the Roman Josi insurgent campaign.
I mean, they really needed to like finish the season with a crooked record, I think, all out. Curious to get your thoughts on this, though. Canucks are going to win the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, consensus. So this is an amalgamation of six leading American sports books numbers, okay? The consensus favorite right now to win the Stanley Cup is the Carolina Hurricanes, plus 675.
Okay.
Followed up by Edmonton at plus 724. Followed up by the Avalanche at plus 750. You can get them at plus 800 in some places. Not suggesting you do that, but it's interesting. Panthers plus 859. Stars plus 900. Bruins plus 900. Rangers plus 900. Vegas Golden Knights plus 1200. And then you get to Vancouver. That's ninth in the league. Just ahead of the Maple Leafs and the Jets.
Mm-hmm.
That seem right to you?
It doesn't, like, I'm not going to be outraged about it. Could you make an argument for, like, bumping Boston down?
Disrespect.
And the Rangers down, maybe?
You're
and
not
moving
doing the
Canucks
disrespect
closer
thing?
To them? No. Like, we've seen how good Dallas is. We've seen how good Colorado is. Carolina's been ridiculous, especially since they got Gensel. We know, like, Edmonton has McDavid, and that just factors into it so much
and
when you're picking against them.
And Vancouver's kind of flatlined in terms of their results lately, right?
Like, I don't think there's... I get it. Maybe they still have a better record than ninth, right? So if you're just looking at it through that lens, but it's not as if any of these other teams are like posers, right? It's like, oh, that team's a joke. How could you possibly pick them over the Canucks? Like, there are other really, really good teams. And it's not as if they're saying it's impossible for the Canucks to win the cup. So
No.
I don't know.
But
like, I get it.
But they have the fifth best odds among Western Conference teams.
The Western Conference is stacked. The Western Conference is really good.
Okay,
like, that's a huge element of
the only
reasonable concern going into the playoffs for the Canucks. The Western Conference is good.
Okay, so let's put it into a tiers exercise.
All right, of course we end up here.
The betting markets suggest the following: the Oilers,
yep,
tier of their own. Well, Oilers and Avs, tier of their own favorites. The Stars, one tier down. The Golden Knights, sort of one other tier down, and then it would kind of be like Canucks, Jets in the same tier, and then LA, and then honestly another tier, and then the Predators. Does that make sense to you?
I think what I would have is Oilers, Stars, Avs, all in one tier.
I would have the Avs alone.
That's fair. Oilers, Stars, Avs, one tier, and then I would have probably the Canucks and the Kings in their own tier, and then LA, and then Nashville.
The Knights.
Yeah, sorry.
You got
yeah,
the Canucks in the same
Knights.
Tier as the Knights.
Yeah.
I can't agree with that. Because... I just think the Knights I've struggled to imagine that if everything goes right for the Knights, I think the upside's a lot higher.
Mm.
You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think if everything goes right for the Canucks, well, I mean, not to say they couldn't win it, but I feel like it would require an Avalanche loss, whereas I could see the Knights getting everyone healthy, getting everyone back, and like beating the Avs in a 7-game series. You know, it's just like slightly different. So for me, I'd tier those a little bit differently. I'd have Vegas probably with Edmonton, to be honest with you, and Dallas in a tier beneath the Avs.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, we've talked so much about Vegas, but I can see that.
Yeah,
I just think to me the three best teams are in the West: Dallas, Edmonton, and Colorado.
Yeah,
and if you want to put Colorado first, that's fine. I don't disagree with that, but I just think those all three of those teams really, really good.
Well, I just think it's interesting that remains a sort of lagging indicator.
Mm.
Just wanted to spotlight that.
Yeah. I just don't think there's anything like inherently unfair with that ranking necessarily. All right. We'll leave it there for today. Back for a Friday edition of the show tomorrow. Thanks for listening. You've got it on Sportsnet 650.